Welcome to Inflection Point Podcast, where we cultivate change from the inside out as we ponder the Cairo question. Will Cairo have to protest in his lifetime for the birthright to freely and peacefully exist in the skin in which he was born? We stand on the belief that dismantling racism goes beyond laws and legislation or politics and economics. Here, anti-racism activation is presented as an inside job where personal transformation and accountability impact social change. So take a seat at the anti-racism activation table with Inflection Point Podcast.
Thank you for joining us for the newest episode of Inflection Point Podcast. At Inflection Point Podcast, we are dedicated to the art of listening and authentic conversation. We challenge our audience to listen actively and intentionally for the purpose of awareness, understanding, and ultimately personal transformation. I am your host, Anita Russell, and here is a quick hello from Mavis and Gail.
Hi, I'm Mavis Bauman. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hi, I'm Gail Hunter, and welcome to this evening's program.
So if you've been following us, you know that we generally have a particular topic that we want to discuss. And we're going to do the same thing here, but we're doing it with a slight twist to it, because the conversation that we're going to have is something that's probably on a lot of people's minds. And that is what I call America's triple threat: fear, racism, and guns. And the different little twist that we're taking is that we've been actually doing some research into news articles, people who have written books that kind of talk about this particular topic. So I'm going to turn it over to Gail first, and she's going to open up our conversation. And one of the things that we have seen in the news is an article that kind of asks this question: why are Americans shooting strangers and neighbors? And this is an article that came from the Washington Post. So we're going to let Gail lead us in a discussion digging into that article and some of the answers that are behind that question.
Thank you, Anita. So it's, as Anita said, it's from the Washington Post. And what they say that in the title of the article is it all goes back to fear. He said, and the questions are, why are cheerleaders getting shot for opening the wrong door? Why is a grown man scared to go into a boot store, as Anita said, without carrying his weapon? Why is everyone so afraid? And across the country this past April alone, at least four men have opened fire on someone who stumbled upon their space, who resulted in one death, two injuries, and a car pocketed with bullet holes. The apparent acts of snap aggression like this have reinvigorated the debate around the prevalence of stand your ground laws in the United States, and a pressing question that says, why are people so quick to pull the trigger on strangers? And why did a 65-year-old man kill a 20-year-old woman who just pulled into his driveway accidentally? Why recently the 84-year-old man who fired two bullets into a 16-year-old boy who had mistakenly knocked on his door in Kansas City? And the list goes on and on. Experts say that they blame a cocktail of factors: the easy availability of guns, misconceptions around stand your ground laws, marketing of firearms for self-defense, and a growing sense among Americans, particularly Republicans, that safety in their backyard is deteriorating. Since 2020, the share of Republicans who said the crime is rising in their community has jumped from 38% to 73%. Now, this is just some people that are saying that it's been on a rise. And that's according to the latest Gallup poll numbers from last fall. Democrats had their concern climbed only about 5% of points to the 42% mark compared to the 73% mark. So we seem to be having obviously an era where Black men and boys are seen as targets, even children that are seen as targets. The perception that life is getting more dangerous, it's spread rampantly through many different communities and populations without any evidence that that's actually existing. Some more of the conservative news channels have devoted more airtime to violence than their center and left-leaning competitors. Over the past 3 years, news channels such as Fox guest spotlighted crime 79% more often than those on several other CNN and MSNBC. And so there's been a rise in the production of news media and information being put out there that crime is on the rise to one targeted group of people more than another, which then creates fear, paranoia, misunderstandings of the law governing self-defense and use of force. And all these together, Jeffrey Corn, chair of criminal law at Texas University Law School, claims that that's all a recipe for tragedy. And he also said that when he was a soldier, he had to go through training just to fire a round of ammunition for weeks before they were actually able to use lively ammunition. In the Washington Post crime analysis of 80 major police departments, records found that reported violence across the country in 2022 was lower than the five-year average. Now, think about that in comparison to what I said originally about how the perception is that the violence has increased. And in the longer term, the National Criminal Victimization Survey showed the number of people reporting sexual assault, robbery, and other physical attacks is overall much lower now than it was in the 1990s, has not increased in recent years. However, homicide and thefts rose during the pandemic, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data, though not to the levels of even what it was in the 1990s. A post-analysis memo found that the states with their stand your ground laws had a 55% higher homicide by firearm rate in the past 2 years than the states that didn't have these laws. And that those the states that didn't have those laws, what is taken out, they remove the duty to retreat from attacker before responding with potentially deadly force. So when they have that law in place, people feel freer to be able just to pull that gun out without even asking questions or inquiring what the person or who the person is. So their belief is that crime has gotten worse, yet the statistics are not showing that except for homicides. So it leads me to think, what's going on here? Where is this paranoia and fear really coming from? When Andrew Lester, the 84-year-old man who shot the young Black boy, Ralph Yar, who came up to his house looking for his siblings, his grandson stated that he has been constantly watching certain news and reading articles and everything that was creating more and more fear in him. And that over the years, his grandfather had become hooked on those channels and was always talking about how his grandson, who was reporting in the article, was more left-leaning, and he found it very disturbing. So what they're finding is that more people are listening to that kind of content and suggestible information that is not necessarily based on any factual truth. So when I look at fear, you know, fear often is known to tell us all distorted belief systems. Fear doesn't tell us truth usually. If there's a tiger running at me, then I have a right to feel afraid, right? And that activates part of my brain, and I go into that fight, flight, or freeze. And as a kid, I'd probably freeze. As an adult, I might fight or I might run away if I can. But if I believe that there's a tiger coming at me and that's not really a tiger, the same part of my nervous system gets activated. And so my reaction could very well be the same as if it actually was a tiger. So think about somebody that is really listening to news over and over again, and perception is being put out there that nothing is safe anymore. And in addition to it, that the majority of the problem is coming from young Black men or young Black boys. That's really creating in the brain a paranoid thought pattern that is activating the nervous system in a way that is going to make them much more easily ready to pick a gun and shoot somebody without checking anything out. I mean, and the same thing as if you've been told as a child that you'll never amount to anything, or parents that are always disappointed in you, then your perception of yourself is distorted based on what you've learned. So even though the truth of who you are is always lying underneath these distortions, just as the truth of racism is always underneath all these distorted belief systems and information that's being put out there. Racism itself has been based on original distortions of truth in order to justify the original kidnapping of people from a different country, from their own homeland, using them for free labor, treating them as if they were less than human. And these imprints have consciously and subconsciously been imprinted on people through the generations. So even though you may say, I don't have or hold that those views on racism, that doesn't mean that in the epigenetics or the generational patterns that can be passed along, even in subtle ways, not just overt ways, they still may be existent. And what's getting activated, I believe, is that that they're getting activated in a way that is very obviously dangerous to many people. So what are white people afraid of? Truth? Being replaced? Being held accountable for racial bias and profiling? The hardest work we all have to do is to look within ourselves to the truth that lies within us and release all that does not come from absolute truth. And so any of these people that shot, that pulled that gun and shot, they never even questioned truth because they never even asked or inquired what that person was there for. And I guarantee, and I really believe that if those two girls that got in the car at the cheerleaders had been white, would they have been shot at? Probably not. If the young man that walked onto this man's porch looking for his brothers or siblings, if he was white, would he have been shot? I'm going to guess probably not. So we all have to take a look at what's really going on here and where this fear is really coming from. The easiest path is always to attach to those fears and distorted beliefs and continue then to project onto others what's really a fear about ourselves and justify our unkindness, our disrespect, our abuse, and the killings of others whose skin is a different color. The choice is to live in fear and distortions or to live in a state of love and truth and non-judgment, which is where truth will always sit. So if you saw two 12-year-old boys with hoodies on, would you react to the one with white skin the same way you would react to the one with black or brown skin? Both may have knocked on your door, both the same height, both would have gotten into your car accidentally or was in a car that pulled into your driveway. What would your reaction be? What would their reaction have been, the people that pulled the gun and shot? There's always another choice to avoid automatically reaching for a gun, for hostile words or hate, for ownership of your own fears and looking within to make sure that there really is a tiger out there in front of you. So that's my belief about what's going on here. And I wanted to know what, Anita, your beliefs were and what your thoughts were about this. And Mavis also.
I just had a quick question. I thought the cheerleaders were white, weren't they? Weren't the cheerleaders white? They were,
I don't believe there was anybody that was white.
Reinforced the trigger happiness to, you know.
But
I thought they were white.
Yeah, so I actually, and that's a good question. And I see this from multiple perspectives, which is the reason why when I was brainstorming on this episode, I looked at that triple threat that there's fear, there's racism, and there's guns.
Right.
But in each one of those, we can find different stories that don't necessarily include the other two. And this is what I mean. With the incident in New York, where the car of young people had driven onto this property, they realized they were in the white wrong place and they immediately pulled off. That was a white girl that was shot.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm making is that the person who pulled the trigger, and I haven't really seen much in terms of the person that pulled the trigger, but the person that pulled the trigger may not have even been motivated by
the color
of their skin. That person could have had a different type of motivation, and maybe it was encased in fear, but it might not have necessarily been something that was racially motivated, right? Unless the person automatically made some sort of assumption. But from the way that I heard the story, the car was driving off and the person came out onto the balcony and started shooting, right? And so I think there's a category of people where it's just the whole gun thing, right? To some of the points that Gail was making, that it's kind of just related to the fact that I have a gun and I can do stand your ground, whatever my interpretation of that is, and I can just shoot somebody, mm-hmm. right? So that's one way of looking at it. But I'm actually going to go into our next segment, which really does focus on the racial aspect and how the racial aspect ties directly in with the fear as it relates historically to gun ownership. So even though I made the statement that we can look at each one of these pillars, if you will, individually, but they are also very intimately related to one another, and especially when you start looking at it through the lens of history. So I'm going to share from a couple of articles, and one of them is an article that came from The Guardian. And the title of this article is Dying of Whiteness, Why Racism is at the Heart of America's Gun Inaction, right? And so the quote from the book is this. Where's my quote? In his new book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racism, of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartline, Jonathan Metzl argues that the intensity and polarization of the U.S. gun debate makes much more sense when understood in the context of whiteness and white privilege. And so he looks at it from the standpoint of, and I'm reading a couple of things from the article, the country's refusal to pass new gun control laws has everything to do with defending racial hierarchy. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to walk you through a couple of points that is being made in his argument. He argues that the intensity and polarization of the U.S. gun debate makes much more sense when you look at it within that context of whiteness and white privilege, right? And so he looks at it from the standpoint of, because it's embedded in whiteness and it's embedded in white privilege, the perceptions are distorted. Like Gail mentioned the word perception and how the older gentleman, when he shot at Ralph Yarrow, his perception was distorted, and it was distorted by watching all of this stuff on the news that, you know, makes all these proclamations about how bad crime is and how, you know, Black people, we're all just criminals and that's all we do is think about how we can harm white people. And so just kind of people defending their status in that racial hierarchy are the ones who will have a tendency to oppose gun control and other things like healthcare. But the point that he's making is that in the process of you acting out on these distorted perceptions, you actually end up hurting yourself, mm-hmm. right? You end up hurting yourself. And one of the examples that that he uses is the majority of Americans' gun death victims are white men. And most of them die from self-inflicted gun wounds. So in all, gun suicide claims the lives of 25,000 Americans per year. And then to look at that a little bit deeper, he focuses on gun suicides among white men, providing some stark figures. For example, in 2014, white men formed 40% of the population, but 80% of gun suicides. And so this whole idea of having guns as a way of protecting myself and all of that is one aspect of it. But if you're just looking at that, I need to protect myself through a distorted perception or a distorted view of the world and distorted from a social perspective, then you could end up doing something like shooting a 15-year-old kid who just rang your doorbell by mistake, right? And so when you look at it through that distorted lens and you tie that distorted lens into things like we've talked about multiple times, Black on Black crime. That is one of those distortions, right? Because when that is projected into the forefront of conversations when it comes to crime, and you're totally missing the fact that white people commit crimes too. White people commit white on white crimes, but yet the conversation is always about Black on Black crime. Again, a distorted perception. So if you're making decisions in your life that are based on these distorted perceptions, and you're a gun owner, you're bound to find yourself potentially in a situation where you have shot at a 15-year-old kid who was just ringing your door looking for his brothers. I mean, but just let that sink in. Because the title of our show is Inflection Point. And I named it Inflection Point for a very specific reason, because it grew out of, you all know my George Floyd origin story, but it kind of grew out of that. And I totally believe that we are in a place where we are on the verge of something dramatically pulling the arc, if you will, in a very different direction. But I think what white people have to understand is part of that inflection point and part of that arc being pulled in a different direction is you being under the microscope. It's you and your thoughts and your ideas and your beliefs and how they are showing up in your words, your actions, and your behaviors on an everyday basis, walking through the world doing everyday things. So when I think about this place that we're in right now, there's a lot of emphasis that's now being placed on whiteness. And I think for very, very good reason, because you can't keep hiding behind that veil. And these killings that we're seeing are evidence of that, that you can't keep hiding behind the veil. At some point, you have to begin to own and understand the role that you play in all of this, right? So I'm going to read a little bit further. Carrying a gun in public has always been coded as a white privilege, right? And so he goes on to talk about in colonial America, landowners, i.e. slave owners, could carry guns. And that right was bestowed on poor whites in order to prevent uprisings from the slaves. So we got to have these guns. We got to have all of this stuff in control because we need to keep these Black people in the place that we have designated for them to be in, right? Then you think about the KKK. And the KKK was all about disarming Black people in whatever way, whether educationally we were disarmed, socially, we were disarmed. Economically, we just were disarmed. So then if you go back to the 60s, you know, in the 60s, the rise of the Black Panther movement, Malcolm X, you got Martin Luther King, Huey Newton, all of these people, these Black people that were beginning to stand up. And the Panthers were taking up arms. They were taking up arms in defense of our community. We need to protect ourselves. We need to protect our community. But then, as the author says, all of a sudden, the Second Amendment didn't apply in the minds of white people, because the Second Amendment was not meant to give Black people the right to defend themselves. It was set up for white people to have the right to defend themselves. So now all of a sudden, we need to have more gun control. That was the conversation in that time period, because Black people were taking up arms according to the Second Amendment the same amendment that drives white people taking up arms, but the fact that we were taking up arms, now we need to have gun control. And so if you just think about that, and again, your perception. So there was something else that I thought was really interesting that I had read. Let me see if I can find it real quick. It was a particular quote, and it was where the author was talking about, oh, here it is. Again, it's this whole idea of this gun culture where guns were central to the life of white folks, but it wasn't intended to be central to the life of anybody else, even if it meant just in defense of my community, right? And there was, I believe the author was at a particular event and a question was asked, and one of the participants answered the question. I believe the question was, what does having guns mean to you? And for this particular participant, the answer was, guns mean freedom, liberty, and patriotism. That's what it means in their perception, which is veiled by their whiteness and veiled by this whole idea of white supremacy, because that those three words did not apply to the Black Panthers and Malcolm X and other individuals in that time period taking up arms to defend the Black community. All of a sudden, it's seen as a threat. It's not seen as freedom. It's not seen as liberty. It's not seen as patriotism. So that means those words apply to certain people. Comments? We got about 2 minutes and then we'll go to break.
And what's wrong with that picture, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it forces me to recall how frightened I was of the concept of the Black Panthers. I didn't learn until recently. Mm-hmm. They weren't a violent group. They were just a group that said, we get to protect our community.
Right. Exactly.
And so the message that came to me was to be frightened of them, that this was a violent group. I think it's fascinating how the Second Amendment, I mean, what are people telling themselves, white people, you know, this is for me and not you.
That's exactly what they're telling themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, it's that distorted perception. So you mm-hmm. have a completely distorted perception of what freedom and liberty means. Because when you think about it, the work that we do, Black folks as activists and protesters and all of that, we're fighting for freedom and liberty, but it's not the freedom and liberty that you are fighting for when it comes to the Second Amendment.
Exactly.
This is true freedom and liberty that we're talking
for everybody. Yeah.
Exactly. 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 Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a break at this point. And when we get back, we will continue the conversation and Mavis is going to pick it up with another intriguing topic.
Are you ready to branch out, to take a leap of faith, to love yourself and others fully? Hi, I'm Erica Gifford Mills, founder of Balance Symmetry and host of Get Rooted Radio. If you answered yes to even one of the above, then this 12-week course is for you. The Rooted Life Group Coaching Series will give you the tools, techniques, and strength to be intentional in your pursuit of what sets your soul on fire. Find out more about this program on my website, GetRootedRadio.com.
The Crystal Coach Show, sharing clarity, guidance, and practical wisdom with me, Anahata, every first and third Monday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. On The Crystal Coach Show, we channel divine wisdom through stories of service, spirituality, and stones for self-care. Feel connected and reside in the vibration of love. For more information and to connect with me, visit TheCrystalCoach.com. That's The Crystal Coach.
It's a quick tip from Jason and Patricia at the Ecosystem Approach Show. This is a way to improve your long-term relationships. As you go through life with your partner, Their hurts, resentments, and conflicts are energies that build up. Your relationship holds on to these energies, and the relationship feels dull, boring, and unattractive. The love you felt originally starts to break down.
Do this. Say to yourself, I direct all my resources in all dimensions to eliminate. Name a hurt or resentment that you've had recently. Maybe it's something you're angry about. Take a breath and blow the hurt, anger, and resentment into the processor shown behind us. Keep doing it.
If you want to hear about this topic, go to our website, theecosystemapproach.org, and under the radio tab, search for Long-Term Marriage, How to Excel Over Time.
Listen to all of our shows because we teach you how to apply energy techniques for everyday life in ways that are practical and useful.
See you Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific or find us at theecosystemapproach.org.
Are you passionate about impacting social change or working towards anti-racism as a society? Are you willing to deconstruct your innermost thoughts, ideas, and beliefs about racism? Then Inflection Point Podcast, Cultivating Change from the Inside Out, is the show for you. Join Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter in open, honest, and deliberate conversations every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, only on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To Inflection Point Podcast. You are listening to our conversation today where we are discussing America's triple threat, fear, racism, and guns. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Mavis, and she's going to lead us in a discussion of guns are a threat to the body politic.
Great, great. Thanks, Anita. Mm-hmm. I am going to be referring to an article that was in the Atlantic magazine entitled Guns Are a Threat to the Body Politic. And a quote from that is, America must regulate guns, not only to protect life, but to protect its citizens' equal freedoms to speak, assemble, worship, and vote without fear. This was a really fascinating short piece. It starts out, why regulate guns? It's not just the obvious thing to prevent injuries and deaths, but it has to do with a complete accounting of gun ownership. So protesters, gun-carrying protesters, and armed invasions of legislatures demonstrate that guns can inflict more than physical injuries. These guns transform the public sphere on which a constitutional democracy depends. Now, I really identify with this transformation of the public sphere. You know, Gail was talking earlier, and probably Anita too, about what we hear in the news, the perception that anyone can have a gun in a public environment, and they will have the law to back them up if something happens, if they shoot anybody. I was thinking of Kyle Rittenhouse, who just went to some sort of event at night and thought he was in danger and killed two people. And I think, how are we supposed to feel safe in the public sphere anymore if this can happen? America must regulate guns, not only to protect life, but to protect its citizens' equal freedoms to speak, assemble, worship, and vote without fear. This is great here. If legislators and judges do not focus on the freedoms that gun regulation protects guns will threaten those freedoms. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a fascinating twist on it. It seems that I think somewhere in the article it says that the Second Amendment and guns have come to represent total freedom. The Second Amendment had to do with the right to protect your home against invasion, protect your family. The Second Amendment doesn't say you get to carry a gun, go anywhere you want, and shoot whoever gets on your nerves, right? I was interested to learn that throughout, after the establishment of our Constitution, throughout the states, there were many laws regulating guns. Every state had them. But it's really more of a more recent phenomenon that this obsession with, say, open carry, stand your ground has come into being. Anita was mentioning the era of civil rights and the Black Panthers wanting to have guns to protect the Black community. Let me see if I can just find the quote about that, that it was at that time or soon after that the Reagan administration added on freedoms about gun carrying because this fear of with the racial tension had increased. And so before that, it wasn't the case. We didn't hear about guns going off in schools, you know, in the public space. I was saying earlier that I remember in, you know, growing up in Western Nebraska, seeing pickup trucks with gun racks in the back window. And that was a common sight. A lot of farmers had guns. We didn't even talk about them. Those guns were to protect their livestock or put down livestock if someone, one of them was suffering, had to do with hunting. It didn't have anything to do with harming each other. I never heard of that, you know, in the first 25 years of my life. And now it is so commonplace. So there was in the 2008 District of Columbia v. Heller, the Supreme Court found that Americans have a right to keep and bear a handgun in their home for self-defense. In doing so, the court assumed a paradigmatic scene of gun use, that of a law-abiding citizen. So it wasn't the idea of anyone having a gun. It was that reasonable people would know how to use guns reasonably, that law-abiding citizen would be defending his or her household against a criminal invader. But the court did not address scenes in which guns threaten the exercise of liberties by other law-abiding citizens, whether those threats occur in the home or in public. So it's almost as if gun rights have been expanded, even the perception of them, to the point where I get to do anything with my gun if I disagree with somebody. So it's just gone crazy. Over the past 10 years, advocates have sought, with some success, to normalize open carry of firearms in public spaces as they participate in market and political activities. How do you think that's going to go? How do you think that's going to go? The result is not just lone individuals carrying guns while buying coffee at Starbucks or shopping at Walmart. Open carry advocates in militia dress amass at right-wing political protests, including Charlottesville in 2017, at gun sanctuary rallies and anti-lockdown demonstrations, and at Black Lives Matter counter protests. So they're bringing guns in public spaces, seeking to dominate those spaces. And Anita, going back to what you were saying, that the guns were used, you know, the violence was used to intimidate people, you know, after slavery was abolished. We will scare you. We will put on white heads or white hats, and we will carry guns, and we will intimidate you. And it's not against the law, but we will be able to keep you down and keep you living in fear. So just to close on this part, armed mobs threaten democratic life itself. Armed mobs threaten democratic life itself. So I did a little bit more reading. I wanted to really see how this plays out in the racial context. Anita alluded to or talked about how many white men are actually suiciding with their own guns. That is a staggering statistic. And I would love to see how that, just how that element in the algorithm kind of plays out, the sense of maybe this fear, this loss of power in the country. You know, why are white men suiciding? Anyway, I found this other piece about how Black communities are disproportionately affected. So this was in the American Progress an article, and it says the lack of investment in communities of color, coupled with weak gun laws, has resulted in devastatingly high rates of gun violence for Black and Brown people. Notably, gun violence has a disproportionate impact on racial and ethnic minorities and is highly concentrated in a relatively small number of neighborhoods that have historically been under-resourced and racially segregated. This is due to a combination of weak gun laws, systemic racial inequities, including unequal access to safe housing and adequate education and employment opportunities, and a history of disinvestment in public infrastructure and services in the communities of color most affected by gun violence. That harkens back to our the social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. You know, that once again, Black and Brown skin are at a disadvantage. I read another piece in, let's see here what it's called. From the National Library of Medicine, there was a study done. The objective was this: racism is related to policy preferences and behaviors that adversely affect Blacks and appear related to the fear of Blacks. So we've got racism and fear together. Mm-hmm. Together. This study examined whether racism is also related to gun ownership and opposition to gun control in U.S. whites. I just want to pause for a second and mention a story that happened to a friend of mine. She and her husband and her daughter were asleep in their house, and someone entered their home. They rarely have their front door locked, you know, just live in a safe space. And they called out to this person, and the person didn't say much, but they knew someone was in the house. And so my friend ran down the stairs, and here stands this man. He had taken off his shoes at the door, and it was, you know, it was pretty frightening. But fast forward a matter of seconds, turns out to be a young man who knew their daughter, who was drunk, and took off his shoes so he wouldn't make noise. And he was so frightened when he saw the daughter's mother, my friend, that he took off running without his shoes. If she had been one of these people hanging on to this level of fear and owned a gun, this stupid kid might be dead today. It's like there's no ask questions. It's no who are you. And I often wonder too, do people with guns think about really taking a life, or do they just think that they're protecting themselves and there's no cost to that? You know, how must it feel to plug a bullet into somebody? Do you feel proud of yourself? Do you feel that the fear is gone? You know, it doesn't end there by any stretch of the imagination. I shot a gun once. I went skeet shooting with my brother and his wife. And the sense of that gun firing and then the kickback in my body was so repulsive to me. And when I add that to the thought of harming someone, I think, what drives you to that point? What drives you to that point? And how afraid are you? This older man who shot Ralph Jarl, was he sitting on the couch with his gun? You know, is he so afraid that he's got it at the ready for this little kid who's lost? That's what I just can't seem
to figure. I would say the answer to your question is yes.
Yes.
His gun was very
right near.
It was very near. and coming to the door, opening the door, and you see a Black man standing in his mind, a Black man, because his perception was that Ralph was even bigger than what he actually was. And then he just shot, no questions asked.
No questions asked.
Articles that I've read that he actually said, I was scared to death. But the question for me is, you were scared to death of what? Mm-hmm. There was no conversation. Mm-hmm. There was no activity. There was no nothing other than you opening up the door and seeing this young Black man. So that fear, again, it gets back to what Gail was talking about earlier. That fear is not generated by external forces. That fear lies within you.
That's right.
Yeah.
At some point, this is my point. At some point, white people have to begin to analyze.
Well, and take ownership.
What really is the source of my fear? And to take ownership. Right. And that ownership thing, Mavis, and what you said when you were talking about the freedom, because you cannot have absolute freedom where there's no sense of accountability, personal accountability or personal responsibility. And then on the other hand, you want to have relative freedom where there is a sense of personal accountability and responsibility. You
Absolutely.
Can't have it both ways.
Right.
Which
yeah.
way do you want it to be?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. There's this particular article talks about the paradoxical attitudes here. It says racism was related to having a gun in the home and opposition to gun control policies in U.S. whites. The findings help explain U.S. whites' paradoxical attitudes toward gun ownership and gun control. So here, white men are killing themselves, don't want gun control, but they're dying from their own guns and really taking away the freedoms of many, many others.
Well,
anybody else at the end of that gun.
And their choice to do that is based on their own internal fears mm-hmm. that they are then projecting out onto that person in front of them, right? They're not based in any right. absolute truth. They don't even check
exactly.
out to see what the truth is. It's
exactly.
the relation of feeding those fears.
Mm-hmm. Couple more points here. Blacks are disproportionately represented in U.S. firearm homicides and would benefit most from improved gun controls. Well, we know that. Whites reporting twice the rate of personal gun ownership and having a gun in the home than is reported by Blacks. Proponents of gun ownership rights cite self-protection and safety as their primary argument for owning guns and resisting gun reform. Well, you know, gun ownership is not the absolute question. Defending your property is the,
yeah, it's
the
not,
amendment yeah. is not the issue.
Definitely.
It's this expanded freedom with guns.
Right. Because even with the story that you just told, and I could kind of argue that if the mom had come downstairs with a gun and fired the gun, I could see the justification in that, because here's this strange
legally. Person. Right.
Legally,
right.
Yeah. There's a strange mm-hmm. person that is inside their home,
mm-hmm.
which is very different from Ralph Jarl, because Ralph right. Jarl was, he was standing outside.
He was outside. Right.
And so
right.
I think we have to just always be incredibly.
We got to calm down. We got to calm down.
And just being incredibly mindful.
Yeah.
Because it keeps getting back to, who are you as a person? Mm-hmm. Who mm-hmm. are you as you walk through the world? Who are you? Are
yeah.
you the person who believes in absolute white supremacy? You need to examine yourself and see, is that really who I am? And if that really is who you are, then the next question is that where I want to stay? Is that who I really want to be?
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
it gets down to this question of self-examination, in addition to, you know, the bigger debate and the laws and all of that. It gets down to
right.
who the heck are you
Where
as
am I?
A human being, as you walk through life, as you encounter people who are different from you, how do you respond?
And why are you afraid?
And why are you afraid?
Why are you afraid?
or where the fear, where is the fear coming from?
Yeah.
Where is it really
right.
coming from within yeah. you?
And you all have heard me say so many times, Black people are not interested in being you.
Yeah.
Black people are not interested in stealing your
yeah.
power.
No.
We're not interested in walking in your pseudo supremacy shoes. What we want is to be left alone. Because we can create our own shoes. We can design our own shoes. We can build our own stuff. We've proven that. We've had communities mm-hmm. where we built our own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was your firebombs that destroyed that community.
Right.
Or your violence that destroyed those communities. So it's not that we can't do this. Just leave us alone. Stop throwing things across my path.
Or that you intend to be violent.
Or yeah, exactly.
You intend to be violent to accomplish those things.
Right.
Yeah. Here's another piece I pulled out. The anti-Black effect is not necessarily conscious or deliberative, but may be felt as fear, anger, unease, and hostility towards Blacks. So that goes back to knowing what you believe. Who are you?
Yeah, who are you?
Yeah.
Who are
whether
you?
It's conscious or not, you gotta figure it out.
Well, and how much truth is that belief based in? Absolute truth.
Mm.
Yeah,
not perceived
yeah.
truth, right? But absolute truth.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so much, and you know, if
you ever look for a positive headline in the news, you will not find it. You will not find it. There is a serious responsibility that we need to place on journalists and media, people in the media, to not skew these perceptions. I know that it's hard to look away from a train wreck, you know, that people just want to click on this stuff. But it's like on my weather app, it will say 60 million people could be affected by the storm. It's not 60 million are affected. It's just going through the country, but it's awfulizing the situation. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, we just used to look at the sky, what's happening, and not seeing those inflammatory statements. You know, somebody was shot again. Oh, you know, people are running their racist thoughts in their head before they even know the facts.
Right.
And so I just caution people as they read these headlines,
right.
Examine what your thoughts are before you even know the facts, you know, especially in this day of opinionated, you know, or opinion. It's really not journalism. It's more just sharing opinions
right.
in a lot of cases.
Yeah. This is some deep stuff.
Right. The facts I was sharing about the crime. The crime is increasing, is it? No, statistically, it's not, except for, right?
Again, it's the
and states that have that, you know.
Yeah.
Gun homicides.
Yeah.
Right, because of unhomicides.
Yeah, was that homicide number that you gave just relating to gun deaths? Or was it homicides by any means? Do you know?
I don't know if it differentiated that.
Yeah.
I have to look at for it again.
Well, I just think of all the times I've been lost. I think of the times that I've had an accident. You know, I hit a deer once on the road. Mm-hmm. All the times that I've been completely vulnerable. And people have appeared immediately and helped me.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be the case if I were a 16-year-old Black kid? Would that be the case?
Yeah.
Not from what we're learning here and what we're trying to encourage people to be aware of. These are precious lives mm-hmm. that are being affected.
And we are nearly out of time. So the last message that I want to just leave to people is be willing to examine your own perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And before you react, before you pull the trigger, maybe stop and think, what am I seeing? And maybe what I'm seeing or what I think I'm seeing is not really what's there. Okay. So we are literally out of time, and I'm just going to leave you with this one final quote. And this is from the Jonathan Metzl, the book that I was quoting earlier. White Americans are then literally dying of whiteness. This is because white America's investment in maintaining an imagined place atop a racial hierarchy, that is an investment in a sense of whiteness, ironically harms the aggregate well-being of U.S. whites as a demographic group, thereby making whiteness itself a negative health indicator.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a powerful statement. And I'm just going to let that statement rest, kind of float in the air to those people who may be listening to this. We are officially out of time. So I just want to thank you for joining us, and we'll see you the next time on Inflection Point Podcast, right here on Transformation Talk Radio. We are here every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific time and 6 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll see you for the next conversation. Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers.